The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis, and this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. Coming up in today's show, James Murphy drops in to talk about his new LCD Sound System album and explains why he thinks the downfall of the music industry began when it turned to the cassette tape.
I liked not being able to find a record. I liked mythologizing records. I didn't know if they existed or not. The objectness is gone, and I don't think that's kids' fault at all. I think it's the record company's fault.
Singles Club this week features The Mystery Jets, Kelly from Block Party and Solo Guys, and my choice, which I don't actually know how to pronounce the band's name. And King of the Samples, Matthew Herbert, talks to us about performing every single sound on his new album 1-1 and how he overcame his fear of singing.
I got very stuck on one record, so I rushed out and bought some slippers and came back in the slippers. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to break the conventions.
That's all in Music Weekly. Hello, 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 everybody. I may as well explain to listeners that I've had about 3 hours sleep due to my baby daughter keeping me awake most of last night, so I'm sort of hysterical with fatigue. So we will see how today's podcast goes. But helping me along in the studio, Rosie Swash.
Hello.
Hello. It says here on my script, keep opening chat brief or it will get cut. Hi, Alex. How are you doing? Also with me, Alex Needham, the editor of guardian.co.uk/culture. How are you, Alex?
I'm good, thanks, Alexis.
Excellent. Clearly, what I thought was...
Do you know what? I've actually got some interesting news about my driving lessons.
Have you? Whoa, come on, right, okay. Come on, tell you what, we'll drop the interview with Matthew Herbert. What is going on in the world of your driving?
I'll keep it brief. My driving instructor managed to take me through one of the main thoroughfares to Emirates Stadium just before the Arsenal match kicked off.
Wow.
Hundreds of drunk men in the middle of the road with me trying to drive through them. Thanks, Anna.
Was it amazing?
It was the most humiliating and intimidating experiences of my life.
Wow.
But I didn't run anyone over.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you run anyone over? Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. So, I mean, you know, it can only be a matter of time before you win the Formula One championship,
yeah, exactly,
or something. Incredible. On Monday, LCD Sound System released their hotly anticipated and indeed final album, This Is Happening. We're huge fans of the New York electro indie punk funk, call it what you like, act here on the podcast. We were super duper keen to talk to them and also chat over the album with Rosie and Alex too. We can hear Rosie speaking with LCD frontman James Murphy shortly, but first, a track from the album, in fact, the closing track from the album, the last song LCD Sound System will ever record, This Is Home.
Just do it right, make it perfect and real, because it's everything, though everything was never the deal. So grab your things and stumble into the night, so we can shut the door and shut the door on terrible times.
One of the things that I like about your music, which is the reason why I like this new album so much, is your lyrics. And I think you're capable of being witty and erudite and sentimental all in one song without seeming to try too hard. And for example, there's a line in Home which really stuck with me, which is, you're scared of what you need, if you weren't, I don't know what we'd talk about. And it made me wonder how you go about writing your songs, because it made, you know, that just sounds so like a conversation you've just had with someone. Do you have a switch in your brain that goes on and you're like, right, I'm in songwriting mode, so I'm collecting material? You know, do you borrow from your friend's dilemmas to fund your songwriting?
I mean, definitely. I don't think it's much different than normal conversation for me, or writing anything. Like if you write a story, if people write books or write stories, they always steal from the kind of conversations that they have with people. Otherwise, I think it winds up feeling really plastic. And I think, I tend to think that most rock lyrics are very, very, very plastic. I don't like them. Not that I think mine are particularly good. I just, they make sense to me as why, you know, as writing lyrics. But for the most part, I think I'm lucky that I have interesting friends and smart friends, and we have kind of conversations that I find really, really funny and kind of embarrassing, and that helps allow me to steal stuff from them and wind up being funny.
I guess what you were saying about, you know, rock lyrics being very plastic is the difference would be that with a lot of songwriters, they look inwards, and it feels like your songs are looking outwards, or the inspiration for them is you looking outwards.
Well, I don't know I don't know that songwriters look inwards. I think usually they try to find a way to look like they look inwards. I think there's a series of like rock gestures, essentially invented by the Rolling Stones or whomever, like just kind of just concocted as a like to make that make you look a certain way. They're like clothing, and you contort your face in a certain way, and you seem like you're emoting, and you sing in this pained way, and it's supposed to, it just translates as like sort of the way that like early like teenagers starting to figure out themselves, some of them just figure out how to seem confident, like certain ones maybe athletes or whatever, they just have this series of gestures that makes them seem self-possessed, and it's not true, but it functions, it works, and people tend to leave them alone and be afraid of them. And I think lyrics tend to be like that. It's what I call the I feel what you feel. You know, if you keep it vague and you emote, people might want to project their own feelings onto you, and that usually translates into a successful rock career. I always like the feeling that there's something more behind something, that if you dug a little deeper and if you kept working at it, it would continue to meet you in terms of meaning, as rather than feeling like, oh, if you dug a little bit, it just realized how shitty it is, and that's a feeling that makes me sad, you know? It's like, you know, finding out your parents don't really care. One touch is never enough.
People who need to push the back of the bus. Well, I read, I don't know if it's true, that you recently, when you were playing some of the new songs from the album, you implored the crowd not to leak or file share the album, and that it wasn't a monetary thing, but because it's yours, I guess. And I can't imagine any 14-year-olds now experiencing something, you know, that they would look back on in years to come if someone just sends them an MP3.
I don't think they'll even know most of the time if they bought it or if they got it from somewhere where they got it, which is not, I'm not to put primacy on my experience is better than their experience. I mean, they get to hear about something and immediately find out what it's like, which is also quite interesting. You know, and that's like, in a way, it's like a good day in a great record store without this feeling of specialness. And I think that feeling of specialness is pretty important. Like, I liked not being able to find a record. I liked mythologizing records that I didn't know if they existed or not. And I couldn't really find out unless I saw them, because I couldn't trust anybody to really know what they were talking about. And that's kind of gone. I think the objectness is gone, and I don't think that's kids' fault at all. I think it's the record company's fault. The minute their decisions about compact discs and how much money they can make with them, I think, is what destroyed the object. Because at the time of the CD came out, there were two dominant formats, and that was cassette and vinyl. And one of them was a thing for people who cared about music, and it was something you took care of, and it was something that you held, and something that you thought was special. Every part of it was special. The inner sleeve, the poster that came with it, the jacket, the record, the label. The other thing was this temporary kind of toy that was for little kids and for your car or for your Walkman. It was just there you knew that it wasn't the thing. When they made CDs, they looked at those two formats and I think idiotically chose cassette. The plastic jewel case is like a cassette box. And a cassette was something that you knew the case was interchangeable, like you broke the case, you just got a new case, or you just threw the case away. And eventually most people just kept the cassettes and threw the artwork and the case away. The artwork was so flimsy. And CDs were just like that. They were these plastic boxes that broke, and flimsy, crappy artwork that was basically just a cut-down version of the vinyl. And the fact that they didn't choose to make CDs look like little records, the fact that they made them... Here they had it. It was done for them. It was a circle. It was sitting there like, hey, idiots, just make these like records. You know, make the little cardboard sleeves that they come in and make the art look feel nice. No, they were just too greedy. There's nothing magical about them. And now they just take the data off the CD and put it on their computer. And so why would you think anyone would want to buy an MP3 or, you know? I mean, I can see how people might ethically want to buy an MP3. They feel, you know, like feel some sort of... They feel beholden to a certain degree to the artist or to the label or whatever to buy it. But as far as the thing itself, there's no reward. unlike with a vinyl, like, you have it and it's forever. You can write your initials in the inside of the jacket. You know, I got a lot of happiness out of that sense of objectness, you know. And now people, what they do is they try to hype that sense of objectness and release special deluxe packages and things like that. But I've always hated that too. I always just wanted the record.
I have a good grip on both of them, because I have stayed home and have learned a little more about my neighborhood, which is important. You know, it's one of the good places to meet.
That was Rosie talking to James Murphy. He's an interesting man, isn't he?
He's very
A lot of opinions about things.
Indeed. Some of them negative, some of them not.
Absolutely. Some positive opinions and some negative. Good to have a spread. Have we all listened to the album? Class.
Yes.
Have we all? Right. What do we think about it? Alex, do you like it?
I do like it, yeah. I mean, it's in a way, it's kind of more of the same, but it's a,
yeah,
pretty, it's a pretty amazing same, isn't it? Mm. So it's not totally groundbreaking from what they did before. And some of the kind of references, like, you know, Brian Eno, Talking Heads,
yeah,
they're a little bit familiar now, but it's still, he's still got an incredible way with, you know, they're really good songs. His voice has really improved, I think.
Mm. With the last album, Sound of Silver, which, you know, ended up in a lot of kind of critics and magazines, sort of best albums of the decade, poll, things like that, of the noughties. I think what was sort of striking about that as an album was it suddenly revealed this new emotional territory for LCD Sound System. In the, up to that point, it was kind of this slightly knowing, almost novelty-ish prankster thing going on with songs like Daft Punk Is Playing at My House and Losing My Edge.
Mm.
And then suddenly he makes this album, this incredibly heartfelt, moving kind of record about growing older and stuff like that. And it's sort of more of the same, as you say, on this record. It doesn't sort of map out any new emotional terrain. There's still, you know, more songs about feeling a bit old on a dance floor.
Mm.
But for saying that, they're really good songs, great tunes and stuff like that. Rosie.
Exactly, he's got his, you know, he's got his corner, he's got his niche, and he does it so well that even if LCD Sound System stayed together and just kept making records like this for the next 10 years, I think I'd be very happy with it. But it's interesting what you say about, you know, his theme, one of his themes being getting older, because I think there's a crop of dance records coming up this summer, one of which we were talking about last week, which is Robin. And we were discussing how Robin's record label were quite keen to sort of avoid talk of her age, which is 31, which is not very old.
Poor old soul.
Poor old.
Honestly.
Ropey old bird.
She'll be dead soon, right.
And I think that's a real shame that you should desperately try and only market dance music to young people and only make it about a young person's territory, because there are lots of people who do it, who do, older people who do it very, very well, of which LCD Sound System is one of them, and make a point of it rather than try and hide away from it.
I think there's something quite inclusive about them as well, and part of that is because, you know, he's a 40-year-old, slightly, you know, not amazingly good-looking,
yeah, like a pudgy guy,
yeah, exactly. like a scruff bag. You know, he's not like a super hipster. And although they've got very kind of trendy references, and there is the slight element of the musical snob, as was in
evidence. We were saying that about his interview. There was a little bit of, like, he doesn't like cassettes, he doesn't like CDs, he doesn't like special edition albums. He doesn't like, what's he like?
Well, he likes it how it was when he was a teenager, which you can understand.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's a classic record boy, isn't he?
I like the fact they're splitting up.
Yeah.
Because there's a line on the sleeve notes to Big Black's final album, Songs About Fucking, which they again announced they were splitting up before the album came out. And Steve Albini from Big Black said, splitting up is an idea that occurs to too few bands.
Oh, definitely.
And I think that's really, really true. And although, you know, he seems to be quitting at the top of his game, I would much rather any band went out on a relative high. You know what I mean? Like this album, rather than plodding on and all that sort of Oasis forced march approach to stardom, you know.
Yeah, three great albums. I mean, he kind of defined, you know, in a lot of regard, he's sort of defined the last decade for a lot of people, and I think it's good that he sees it's been a great 10 years and bows out. Whether they'll actually be helped, you know, no bands do stay
no bands no 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 now, if you get the chance to see them before they split up, I would also wholeheartedly recommend it. They are a really, really good live band, LCD. I saw them in New York a couple of years ago supporting Arcade Fire. and they kicked the Arcade Fire's ass. I thought they made the Arcade Fire look really silly. This Is Happening by LCD Sound System is released on Monday. Let's move on to Singles Club, the place where we have a chat about the recent releases that we kind of dig. First up, it's Rosie's Choice. When you walk into the room, girls ground boys swoon. You're the spark that lights the gloom, and my heart sings to your tune. That's a slightly odd lyric. That was Flash A Hungry Smile by the Mystery Jets. That's Rosie's Choice. It Rosie, tell us why you brought that in, please.
Well, I've said it before on this podcast. Everybody knows that I'm a huge fan of the Mystery Jets. I think they're one of the few good indie bands around, you know, that give that title, that, you know, beleaguered title, something to be proud of. I think they do Whimsical very well. I think they do those huge, chunky pop hooks. Mm. Very well, and I think there's a real Englishness to them. They've got a sort of cheeky romanticism, and it's all on this record. I think I've always wondered why they weren't bigger. I thought they were a bit underrated, and I think that their previous record label, 679, didn't help. Maybe now that they're on Rough Trade now, right?
They have signed to Rough Trade, correct.
That might push them a little bit further. But then I see that they're playing Reading Main Stage in the summer, and the few times that I've seen them live, they've had such an active crowd, an active live following, that maybe I'm wrong about that, but I just think they're excellent, and I think this record is too.
I think it's a really good album. I confess a sort of vested interest here in that they are. I know and like the Mystery Jets, and they asked me to write the record company biog for this record, and it's not something I do very often, but I, like you, Rosie, I feel that they're a band that deserves to do a bit better, and whatever I can detail, blah, blah. So I heard some of this album last year in the studio, and I thought then it was really good. In fact, I wasn't that keen on the last record, which I thought was a bit... It's one of those records that made me feel quite old. In that I thought it was very clearly aimed at people a lot younger than me. It's sort of lyrical themes and da-da-da. Whereas I think this record is a really interesting one, and that is a pretty good example of what goes on it. Alex?
I really liked it as well. In fact, I think it's the best single for, well, since the first album, which I liked
I was a huge fan
more than the second one. I don't know, the chorus sounds very familiar in a sort of in a good way, as in you know, it sounds like it should be a big hit, but I wonder whether they're not necessarily doomed, but whether they're going to become this decade's super furry animals, where they make interesting records.
What a very good comparison
to a kind of devoted following doing pop, but stuff that's slightly too weird for the mainstream.
That doesn't actually sound unlike Super Furry Animals, that track, does it?
Yeah. No.
I hadn't. That's not something that I'd thought of at all. I think you might have a point. I think maybe they're just slightly too off-kilter for mainstream sort of acceptance, maybe. I don't know. But if any single's going to sort of change that, maybe this is the one that will do it. Okay, well, three thumbs up for Flash A Hungry Smile by the Mystery Jets. It's not out until July, but you can listen to it on YouTube now. And now we can hear Alex Needham's Choice. That was Tenderoni by Kelly, better known as the frontman of Bloc Party. Pretty radical new direction.
This is quite radical. Bloc Party, he always used to say that the kind of music Bloc Party made wasn't necessarily his favourite kind of thing. Mm. He'd rather be making pop and R&B records.
Yeah, he always was one of these guys that went on and on in interviews about, oh, what I really like is R&B and dubstep and da-da-da. And you sort of... thought, yeah, well, why do you make records sound like The Cure then?
yeah, exactly.
But yes, anyway, carry on.
But yes, he made this in New York last year with the producer, the XXX Change.
Wow. Oh, we've come across him before, haven't we? Yes. Okay, great.
And it sounds quite a lot like Wiley's Wearing My Rolex.
It certainly does.
Although the kind of verses actually sound like Bloc Party, a Bloc Party song over Wearing My Rolex, but I think the chorus is very good, like the sort of distortion and how kind of mad it is.
Do you think Bloc Party fans are going to have it? There is a fairly radical change of direction in all sorts of ways here for Kelly. You know, he's on the front cover of Attitude with his top off, looking, as we said, a lot perkier than he normally. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Bit of a sulky character when I met him. And you know, it's an interesting interview about his sexuality, about, you know, being a kind of gay black man, all that sort of thing. He's come out with a pretty boshing dance track. Do you think people who buy Bloc Party records are going to have it?
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because in a way, the bottom's fallen out of the indie market,
yeah.
And now everybody's into pop. So perhaps it could be a very smart move.
Yeah, it could well be. Do you think it's a smart move, Rosie?
I don't know if it's a smart move, but I actually do think that Bloc Party had a vague dance element in it, I would put that down probably more to Matt Tong's drumming, which I've always been a big fan of. I could watch him drum all day, and I think it's a bit of a departure, but I don't think it's too ridiculously different. And as Alex said, it's not so different from a lot of the other stuff that's out now. And I think he's making a bit of a statement with this being the first single, because it's called Tenderoni, which is obviously not an indie reference.
No,
as a name, and the synth line being such an electro sound that's kind of so present at the moment. It seems to me more of a statement of a record, just to say, if anyone's unsure about where I'm going next, this is exactly it.
It does sound a really convincing sort of dance pop record. It doesn't sound like somebody like dabbling, or somebody doing it in a kind of half-assed way, or somebody sort of doing it in a kind of inverted commas ironic way, I think, which is nice.
Yeah, definitely. No, he's properly gone for it.
So I'm good for Kelly and Tenderoni, which is out on the 14th of June. Now it's my turn. That was No Summer For You, all one word with a number four, by a band who I mean, it's spelt lowercase o, capital O, lowercase o, two capital O's. Ooh, I don't know, I've no idea. I will tell you how I came across this record. I came to mock and stayed to marvel. I was reading an interview with Milo from The Big Pink in NME, and they were saying, what's the hot, you know, stuff that you're digging at the moment? And every single record he chose had a title that sounded like it had been made up by Charlie Brooker for a joke, including No Summer For You by Ooh. And I thought, I was sort of a bit bored, and I thought, oh, here's a laugh. I'll have a laugh at some stupid hipsters making kind of, you know, knobhead music, and as I believe the technical term is. And I went and looked this track up, and I thought it was really good. So who's the fool now? Who's the knobhead now? Me. I don't know anything about this band. This track's been knocking about on the internet since the end of last year. I don't think it's been signed. It is a cover of a sort of 90s or late 80s or 90s dance track that I've never heard of. And I am reliably informed that the Ooh are sort of big on the goth, kind of goth dubstep electro crossover scene. Which, you know, I mean, if it exists, I didn't know. But I really liked it. I thought it had a lovely sort of melancholy, sort of floaty air. all that kind of malarkey. Rosie, what did you think of it?
I think Salem probably are on the other the other band on that. I saw that. I do like. I'm a fan of that scene of two bands.
Are you? You're a fan of that scene. You're a committed fan of that scene. I was into it ages ago. It's a bit played out now. Really, it's two bands.
But I like you, I didn't know the original, and I thought, oh God, is this some huge dance hit that I've never heard of before? So I'm relieved that it wasn't, and I didn't like the original very much. So
no, I didn't like the original very much either. Alex, what did you make of it?
I thought it was great. I mean, it was a bit like a sort of, to almost go back to the Kelly Okereke references, but when, you know, at the beginning of the last decade, when Timbaland was making slightly stranger records and the Neptunes were starting, you'd get kind of, occasionally they'd do a ballad and it'd be a slightly druggy, drifting thing with strange noises in it. I thought it was really kind of convincing. It sort of stretched out the original song. It didn't really have that much to do with it, but the original's like a Latin hip hop.
Thing
from the late 80s. But no, I can see what the Big Pink see in it, and you know, it had a strange, even though I guess it's an inversion of a summer hit. In a goth way, it was quite a summery record.
Yeah, it's definitely got a sort of a late afternoon, you know, heat hazy kind of feel to it.
Yeah,
he said abstractly. You can tell I'm a rock critic, but in a brilliant way that I encapsulate things on this program. So we like that as well. We like everything. We're so positive.
I did like everything this week.
I liked everything this week as well. No Summer for You by Ooh is all over the web now. Go out and listen to it. Time for some posts from last week's show. Lots of people came on the message board to talk about Uncle and whether they have ever been relevant or not. Interesting. Southwark Bear writes about James Lavelle. Glad to hear he's not going to end up Christopher Quentin style, propping up club bars until the end of time. But it is a ridiculous vanity project, nor always will be. Ray24, I haven't bought an Uncle album since science fiction, but I'll definitely lend the new one an ear thanks to the Lanigan Factor. That's Mark Lanigan. As opposed to Dickie Lanigan. I don't know what other Lanigan it would be, Alexis. But anyway. Nearly every song the man breathes on is gold. Instinct tells me this could sound quite similar to the Soul Savers releases. And James is right. Lanigan's lyrics are beautiful. Lots of talk about Singles Club. SV80, big fan of the Robin track that you brought in, Rosie. And there was love for my advisory circle choice, too. Go to 100 writes, wow. Wow. Thanks for the tip about Advisory Circle. It's got a bit of Jar about it. That's Jean-Michel Jar, as opposed to Jar of Onions.
Jar of Flies, the grunge band.
Yes, as opposed to Jar of Flies, yes. Or Jar Wobble, indeed, yes. It takes me back to my pre-space shuttle childhood. Oh, and Space 1999. Anyone else remember that? Way better than Star Trek, I used to think. Star Trek was BBC Square, while Space 1999 had ITV Anarcho Chic. Or maybe not. Yeah. Phil Jones, 87, on Michael Hand's contributions last week, writes, the pod should sing each other's tracks in Singles Club every week. That was a lovely addition to this week's selection. Interesting idea. Won't be doing that. No, Phil Jones, 87, we shan't be doing that. Keep the posts coming. guardian.co.uk/musicweekly is the place to leave feedback. And come and find us on Twitter and Facebook too. Since starting out as a house music producer, sampling has been at the heart of Matthew Herbert's work. Rather than sampling old funk and soul records like his contemporaries, Herbert made a decision not to use other people's music in this way, instead recording everyday sounds to make political statements in his tracks. New album, 1-1, is a collection of songs rather than a record aimed at the dance floor. We sent our producer, Pete, along to meet him and talk about the album. And first of all, he wanted to find out what makes a good sample.
If you'd have asked me that question 20 years ago, I think it would have been a very different question. I mean, when I walked into a music shop to buy my first sampler, it had a disc on it, a 3.5-inch floppy disc, and they'd for their demo, they'd chopped up Everybody Dance Now. And the beat, and they'd sort of broken it down into all its component parts, and you could literally just play everybody, and you could chop all the beats up and do all that, and I thought that was tremendously exciting. Now I'm much more interested in the stories of how the samples are there, why they're there, why are you recording them, you know, all those sort of fundamental questions that you would maybe sit down if you were at a blank canvas, going to paint a painting. You know, what am I doing a picture of? Why am I doing it? What materials am I going to use? That kind of thing. A good sample for me now is a sound that the world has never heard before. For example, on my last big band album, on There's Me and There's You, there's a track called Breathe, which starts like this. And that's the sound of 100 people blowing over empty plastic water bottles in the entrance hall of the British Museum. And again, it's an incredibly eerie and evocative and sort of beautiful sound, to my ears at least. I was wanting to sort of protest about the way that we use our resources, and in particular in that instance the fact that we've got perfectly adequate drinking water and yet we're importing water from all around the world in plastic bottles that's not good for us or the planet, and being charged 1,000 times more than a drop of tap water for something that basically does the same job.
Another sample which caught my ear, vomiting outside the arms trade fair.
That was a circumstance where I wanted to. There was an arms fair going on, and I wasn't living in London, so I just wanted to do. I just wanted to sort of think of a way of protesting against an arms fair in sound. You know, that wasn't standing outside the arms fair and shouting, "Arms fairs are rubbish. Down with arms fairs," or whatever. And so just thinking of manifestations of ways to organise sound that can express something other than necessarily how you would express it explicitly if you were to use words. So I just sent a friend and asked him to go and vomit outside the arms fair. And he sort of gave his game attempt, but it's not the best vomiting in the world, I have to say.
Is he known to be able to vomit on demand?
He's quite a shy boy, and he's a very well brought up lad from Birmingham, so it didn't come naturally to him, and I think it took him quite some time to get it together. But I was just recording an album called One Club, which is the second in three that I'm releasing this year. This one's made out of a nightclub in Frankfurt in one evening. I was trying to think of ways whereby we could gather sort of information through sound rather than just having people like clap or say their name or what have you. I had this thing of like whistling, so we got everybody to whistle, just a straight whistle, and then I asked people to, if they were straight, to go, if they were gay, to go, and if you were undecided, to go. You could have a sort of almost like a little social experiment, in the sense that by listening to the sound and what you came back to, you could get a sense of what the sexual orientation was of this 621 group of people in a nightclub. I've got their response here.
So here we go. After three. 1, 2, 3.
So quite an odd sound there, but actually within it, it contains a whole sort of variety of different sort of information. It's just the way it is. I couldn't tell you why.
Let's move on to your current album, 1-1. You've written, performed or recorded every single sound that you can hear in this album, is that right?
It is, yeah.
And you're classically trained, is that fair to say? So
up to a certain standard.
You're able to play some instruments, but presumably you had to learn some of them as well.
I did, yeah. It was definitely a challenge, and I think it was a challenge not just because of my own limited abilities to perform wonderful riffs on an alto clarinet or strum a mean guitar or anything of that, but it was also a challenge to not just bust out my mobile phone and call Dave Okumu from The Invisible, who's an incredible guitarist, and just have him come down and play my music properly. And that was, to be honest, that was the biggest challenge, was actually to make a record that in many ways I feel doesn't sound as good as it could have done, you know.
I read that you used to drink a bottle of wine and get dressed in a tuxedo before singing. I can understand the wine. How did the tuxedo help you?
Well, I'm a big believer in the right shoes for the occasion. I got very stuck on one record, so I rushed out and bought some slippers and came back in the slippers. And it's just about what you're trying to do is you're trying to break the conventions, you know, break the familiarity and break the laziness, you know. I mean, it's so easy to be lazy in music now. I mean, you just plug in a computer, you press drum and bass, and it loads you up a complete set of drum and bass sounds. So I'm always looking for ways to sort of break that impulse to be a lazy git, really. And so one time it might be some sort of cheap incense from the head shop around the corner, or the next day it might be a bottle of wine, or one day it might be change all the lighting and do it in the dark, you know. The other one, it might be take your trousers off and do it, you know, if no one else is about. It makes a kind of frame for home, and at 7 o'clock I won't be late, 'cause I wanna see you through Chestnut Gate. And each step on is a closer step to home. So don't be shy, it's alright here. Underneath this weathered exterior, walls and windows, I'll be there, putting my arms out, putting my arms out. This is home.
Matthew Herbert talking with our producer Pete there. This inspired a degree of lively debate already in the studio. I actually really like this Matthew Herbert album, but, and it's a big but, something about all this stuff about, yeah, I got a Big Mac wrapper and I set fire to it and I recorded it as a protest against deforestation, really, really, really gets on my wick. But it doesn't get on your wig.
No, I thought it was good in a, you know, as he says, in an age where, you know, where we've got so much information coming at us and sound, you know, not that many people try and experiment with sound, do they?
No. Nope.
Really, you know, particularly we've kind of had 10 years of guitar music.
True.
Which has been quite retrogressive. So to experiment with sound and to try and imbue that with some other meaning, I think is quite a noble thing to do, although maybe the way he was expressing it was a little bit worthy.
Got something to vomit outside at arms fair. No, I do actually, I think that is a good argument. And what I would say is, the question is, what's important to him? Is it the end product? Is it the record? Or is it the means by which the record is made?
Well, he was kind of saying there that it's the process, wasn't he? Because yeah. He was saying if it was going to be perfect, he could just get his mate to play the guitar. So it's interesting, isn't it? It's obviously the whole part of it is the journey towards doing it, and you might not necessarily pick that up. So that's a very art way of doing something.
Absolutely, it's like conceptual art, isn't it? Rosie,
I definitely had some preconceptions about Matthew Herbert before I went to listen to this album. I thought it would all be a bit po-faced.
Yeah.
And the concentration on the process of making it might make the end result interesting rather than melodic or, you know, with a tune. And actually, the record that it most reminded, one most reminded me of is the Gorillaz. It's a Gorillaz record.
Interesting.
I really think it sounds far less polished, for sure. But I think it shares a lot of similarities
in terms of mood
and melody, and actually, you know, I mean, I wasn't not necessarily the last Gorillaz record, but the Gorillaz as, you know, as their sound, as you identify, that's what most made me think of. And I think partly I was surprised by that because I'd always thought of him as a bit too jazzy as well.
There is that side to him as well. I mean, I've liked some of his records and not others. He did a single around 1998 called So Now, which I really, really liked, which was just sort of a slightly warped house track. I really enjoyed it. He makes music according to a manifesto.
What's the manifesto?
It's a bunch of stuff about how every sound has to be his own and he can't steal other people's and this, that and the other. It's sort of interesting. Is having a manifesto a good idea, do you think, Alex? Isn't that just a bit like being Noel Gallagher? But do you know what I mean? In another way, isn't it just kind of put an arty spin on, oh, proper music?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it's the opposite to Noel Gallagher in a way, because you are putting artificial strictures on yourself. It's like when they made Dogma films, isn't it?
True.
They ended up breaking the rules, but it was an interesting exercise to try and stick to them. Mm-hmm. Or I suppose it's, you know, it goes back to the Brian Eno way of doing things, isn't it? Where you have your oblique strategies.
I got a packet of oblique strategies as a present of somebody, and I thought I would use them in writing, you know, when I was sort of having problems when I was writing things. And they were worse than useless. the first one I pulled out, I was just like stuck. You know, you're just going to get blocked when you write. And I pulled one out and it said, is it finished? ? That was the obligatory. It's like, no, it's not fucking finished. That's why I pulled the card out. If it was finished, I'd be sat with a cup of tea and a cigarette, not with my oblique strategies cards. 1-1 by Matthew Herbert is out now and is part of a trilogy. One Club, from which I believe contains that amazing sample of people whistling, and One Pig, which samples the entire life of a pig. That's out later in the year. Sadly, we have come to the end of this week's show. My thanks to Alex Needham.
Thanks very much.
Nice to have you in as ever. My thanks to Rosie, as always.
As always.
You're presenting next week, aren't you? I am going on holiday.
Oh, I've forgotten about that. I better gear myself up.
My thanks as ever to producer Pete. I'm Alexis Petridis. I won't see you next time. Rosie will be in the hot seat. I'll see you when I get back from my holidays. Take care.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.